Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's Friday, and that means it's the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. Over the past few months, we've seen a wide range of headlines about the economy. CNN, the U.S. economy grows incredible 5%. Reuters, third quarter U.S. economic growth strongest in 11 years. And The Guardian, U.S. economy grows at fastest pace in a decade. Things are definitely looking up for certain segments of the population. But if you look a little deeper, you'll find articles about the dwindling middle class and people struggling to make ends meet. Today's guest, Jim Tankersley, wrote an in-depth piece for The Washington Post called Why America's Middle Class is Lost. It's about Downey, California, about 6 hours south of San Francisco. And he writes that most jobs in Downey are not coming back. The stock market is soaring, the unemployment rate is finally retreating after the Great Recession, and the economy added 321,000 jobs last month. But all that growth has done nothing to boost pay for the typical American worker. Jim Tankersley is economic correspondent with The Washington Post and editor of The Storyline, and he joins us from Washington. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Arthur Delaney. He's been writing about Republican governors pushing drug tests for nutrition assistance and other safety net programs. He's also been interviewing people who lost their jobs during the recession and have luckily been able to find another one, although it's been incredibly difficult. Arthur is a reporter with the Huffington Post, where he covers unemployment, the economy, and politics. Hi, Arthur. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Great to have you back. And yesterday, the IMF head, Christine Lagarde, said a stronger U.S. economy and a drop in oil prices will not be enough to improve the outlook for global growth this year. Eric regularly covers this. Find his latest pieces, The Saudi Oil Party is Over and The Hangover is Just Beginning. And while oil prices fuel U.S. surge, Russia is on the brink of disaster. Find those at yourcallradio.org. Eric regularly is European correspondent and business columnist for The Globe and Mail. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Well, thank you for having me back. I'm in Rome, and it's really nice to be back.
Oh, okay. You're in Rome. Great. Well, thank you for joining us. So as we always do on Your Call's Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Arthur Delaney with the Huffington Post, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I would love to give kudos, first of all, for Jim Tankersley for his Middle Class series. It was excellent, his story in that series. I would also like to give kudos to my colleague, Michael Calderon, who had a story this week highlighting the New York Times for being the only paper not to publish Charlie Hebdo. I just feel like it's something that has to be emphasized, that they need to be singled out for their standalone status on the cover of that newspaper in France.
Well, why do you think they need to be singled out? And what did you think of the decision?
Well, they don't need to be. I mean, they're singling themselves out, but I just think people ought to realize it, that there's been this question of self-censorship. Mm-hmm. And most major media, with the release of the latest cover, realize we've got to show people these pictures. And I just can't believe anyone would disagree, especially on the most recent image, which is not that offensive.
And also, didn't the Washington Post decided not to republish them?
No, they showed the latest ones. It's really only the Times at this point. It was the Post and the Times and many other big media didn't want to show the racier stuff from Charlie Hebdo's past issues. But I think it's a different story when you've got them publishing 1 week after they were slaughtered.
What was the Huffington Post stance on that?
We've been publishing all their stuff from the get-go. We have not held back.
Hmm. Jim Tankersley with The Washington Post, before you give us kudos, what are your thoughts on different newspapers' decisions to publish or not publish?
I mean, I absolutely supported the Post decision to publish it. I just think of this from really basic newsman terms. This is news. This is a thing that has caused a big news reaction around the world, and something that I think we owe it to our readers to show them what the fuss is about. It seems like a pretty easy editorial judgment, in my view.
Mm. Well, it's also interesting to see the media cover other outlets, like the Washington Post had a piece a few days ago. CNN won't republish Charlie Hebdo cartoons.
Yeah, it's funny. I think that the media loves to cover the media, almost loves to cover raw horse race politics. Those are probably our two favorite things.
Mm.
But it's true. It's very self-indulgent. It also allows you to talk about it in a way that is just a little bit refracted. And so in doing that, I think maybe a little, sometimes media organizations are a little more comfortable having that kind of indirect conversation rather than a direct one.
Right. And so, Jim, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to be horribly shameless here and promote a colleague. My colleague, Lydia DePillis at The Post, who writes for our storyline team, has an amazing five-part series on fracking in Pennsylvania.
Huh.
And it's really all about what do you do when the boom goes bust? And is there a responsible way to handle sort of a sudden wealth of natural resources from a local government standpoint, from an individual worker standpoint, from a small business owner standpoint? Can you catch that wind without being left out in the middle of the desert when it goes completely out, which is what happened in this to a degree in this small Pennsylvania county that she wrote about.
Great. And the five-part series. So this was a really in-depth reporting.
Super in-depth, and they're five relatively short parts, but we like it that way, and it's just sort of an episodic way of telling the story of this corner of Pennsylvania, and like I said, from these different perspectives, the local government perspective. To me, the most fascinating one is the last part. It's the story of a young man, 24 years old, and Ryan, who basically drops out of college to go to work in the fracking field, and he understands that this is a really good-paying job. He also understands that it could go away at any time, and then he might as well chase it around the country. And his father is very much for it, but there's this real question hanging over him, I think, throughout the piece of, is this a smart move in this new economy of ours to give up on education in order to just chase that kind of a job?
Yeah, that sounds great. We'd love to have her on. So thank you for that. We just did a show about fracking in California last week. So thanks for that. That's Jim Tankersley. He is economic correspondent with The Washington Post. And what about you, Eric Reguli, with The Globe and Mail? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
There was a beautiful piece in The Guardian by Roberto Saviano. Do you know him, Rose? He's the Italian author who wrote the book about the mafia in Naples. The mafia there is called the Camorra, and his book is called Gomorra. And it had a huge impact around the world by exposing the truly evil ways of the Naples mafia. What isn't really well known is how his life has been utterly destroyed by this book. When it came out in 2006, he got mafia death threats. That was well known. But for 8 years now, he's been living undercover. And this is really this very long piece in The Guardian, which is written by him and translated in English, told what a misery he lives. He has no life. He lives in police barracks and obscure, cruddy hotels in the middle of nowhere. Hmm. He has to go around with seven bodyguards and two armed limos. And I'll just read you one quote. He says, "It's been more than 8 years since I took a train or rode a Vespa, took a stroll, or went out for a beer." So he has absolutely no social life. And he's a young man, so this is the price that investigative journalists often pay in Italy for exposing the mafia. And, you know, around the world when there's this hard-hitting journalism. And, you know, he didn't actually say, "I regret writing this book." When you read this, you think, my God, would he have done this again? And I don't know.
Wow. It just made me realize, Eric, we don't really hear much about media in Italy. What is the state of independent media in Italy today?
Well, it is independent. There is press freedom here, and it's quite strong. But there's also a lot of intimidation here because the mafia is so strong. Roberto Saviano is only one of God, there's got to be a couple dozen. He says it somewhere in the story here, but I can't find it quickly. But there are several dozen reporters in Italy whose lives have been threatened by the mafia and under police guard. Now, journalists in Italy have been killed,
and they
certainly have been threatened. And it's a very ugly situation here. As a result, there's truly hard-hitting journalism on the mafia is waning, which is very, very sad.
Huh, so it's safe to assume that it's incredibly difficult to do investigative journalism there.
Well, against the mafia, certainly, yeah, because they're violent, and they have been known to kill journalists. So, yeah, it is. I mean, other reporting, certainly less so. I mean, if you go after, you know, the Vatican Bank or the government, certainly there's a lot more freedom.
Hmm. And Eric, did you want to jump in on Charlie Hebdo? How did the Italian media deal with this? And did you see a lot of these cartoons republished in Italy?
Oh, yeah, everywhere. They were republished extensively. There was a lot of sympathy for Charlie Hebdo and the victims. There were rallies in Rome. They weren't certainly as big as some rallies elsewhere. Some newspapers held back a bit. You can ask me for names that I can be able to remember right now. But, you know, it was a balance. Do we publish this, you know, as a support for Charlie Hebdo, or do we realize that, you know, terrorism also happens in Italy and editors have to protect their newsrooms? So there was some of that going on as well.
And that is Eric Reguli, European correspondent and business columnist for The Globe and Mail. Jim Tankersley is economic correspondent with The Washington Post, and Arthur Delaney is a reporter with The Huffington Post, where he covers the economy and unemployment. And you can find links to all of the stories mentioned at yourcallradio.org. So, Eric, there's so many economic stories coming out of Europe with oil prices and the IMF's Christine Lagarde's comment yesterday about what's going to happen to global growth. But first off, I want to ask you about what's happening in Greece. There is a Greek election on January 25th, which I understand you will be covering. And is it the Syriza? Is that how you say the radical?
Yeah, it's Syriza. It's actually a coalition as opposed to a party. It's a radical left party. They are leading in the polls. It looks like they are going to win and form a government. And the interesting angle on Syriza is that they are very much anti-austerity, which I think is a good thing. And what the leader of Syriza wants to do is have a showdown with the European Union on debt. Greece's debt load is enormous, unsustainable, and he wants his debt not entirely eliminated, but written down. And the Europe is scared now. It's really, really rattled, because if the showdown doesn't work, the Grexit, as to use the ugly term to describe a Greek exit, could happen. So after, you know, 3 years after the height of the financial crisis, the prospect of Greece leaving the Eurozone is back. And if it does leave the Eurozone, who's going to be next? Wow. Italy, Spain, Portugal? Yeah, it's ugly here, very ugly.
Can you tell us what else Syriza stands for, in addition to ending austerity and debt? What else is in the platform?
Well, a few years ago, Rose, they were considered an anti-Euro party. They wanted to reprint the draft, and that's vanished. They want to stay in the Eurozone and the euro. What they really want is they want more social spending, because the Greeks have been absolutely devastated. The incomes have fallen by 30%. There's 26% unemployment, 50% youth unemployment. Entire industries have been gutted, and they want to be able to ramp up social spending to protect the people. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they're smart enough to realize they have to finance that. So, you know, one way to do that is reduce your interest and principal payments on this huge, big, fat Greek debt. And who knows whether they're going to be able to do that. I sort of doubt it myself.
Eric, we had a reporter on last year, and the name's escaping me, but she told us that things were so bad in Greece that people went to underground clinics to give each other medicine if they needed it. I mean, it was really, really bad. And so is this happening as a result of basic suffering that people are dealing with?
Oh, yeah, Rose. I go to Greece quite often, you know, three or four times a year. And even though Greece is not in recession anymore officially, even though the economy is growing a little bit, you can't tell. I mean, it's in still very terrible shape socially. Yeah, there's a lot of hunger. There's a lot of drug problems. There's huge problems with prostitution, and the terrible other factor is there's a Nazi party there called a Golden Dawn, which is very, very strong, and it is violent. Most of its members who were elected to parliament are now in prison. They're very much anti-immigrant, and this is a result of the austerity. I mean, there are neighborhoods that are controlled in Athens by Golden Dawn, and they're clever in the sense that they do feed the poorest members of society, and that's how one of the reasons you're getting support.
Hmm. That is Eric Reguli. He's European correspondent and business columnist for The Globe and Mail. And if you have any questions for Eric about what's happening with Europe's economy, how low oil prices are affecting things there, he's going to be covering the Greek election on January 25th. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Eric, I want to ask Arthur and Jim also this question, but how do the media cover the public's reaction to austerity? So, for example, how are the media in Greece or Italy covering it?
In Italy, there's a lot of sympathy for anyone who hates austerity, because there is austerity here as well. It certainly is not as extreme as it is in Greece or even in Spain. But yes, the three main opposition parties in Italy are united against austerity to the point they want Italy out of the Eurozone. They want the lira back. And this is Silvio Berlusconi's party, all the left parties. And, you know, this is Beppe Grillo's party. This is a huge number of politicians and voters really, really hate austerity because they think it's wrecking the economy. And they have a point to some degree, because when you suppress government spending, social spending, the economy falls. So yeah, they're very quite sympathetic here to the Greek cause.
And Jim Tankersley, you wrote an in-depth piece for the Washington Post called "Why America's Middle Class is Lost," and you went to Downey, California, which is about 6 hours south of San Francisco, and talked to a lot of people there who were having a hard time making ends meet. When you hear Eric talk about how the public responds in, you know, somewhere like Italy and Greece, what are your thoughts on what you heard from people in Downey and their frustrations with their economic situation?
Well, it's interesting. It's a complicated story of what's happened to the American middle class from the time when Downey was a boom town. It's a rocket suburb of Los Angeles, by which I mean it was the place where America made its Apollo rockets and its space shuttles. And at one point, the main plant there had like 30,000, 25,000 really good middle-class jobs going, and there were neighborhoods all over town where plant managers and plant workers lived next door to each other, and you knew the difference by how often one of them got a new car, not by who got the new car. And it was this feeling in America there and really across the country, this was after World War II, like we could do anything, and that when our economy grew, it helped everybody out. The feeling there now, and again, I think the polling bears this out across the country, is that that's not the case. That in America, we have seen a lot more growth than Europe has, for example, in the last few years, in part because we have not had as much of a fiscal contraction as most European countries have, and in part because we've had better monetary policy. But that growth hasn't helped people in the middle, really. I mean, at all. Median incomes in America are lower today than they were when the recession ended. And people feel like, yeah, the economy might be going, but it's not helping me. It's not helping people like me get ahead. So I think this is all wrapped up. In the series, I lay out sort of a theory on what structurally has gone wrong in the country that has led to this stagnation in the middle class. But it's something that we really should be worried about, and that people, you know, policymakers globally have to think about, because strong middle classes are, you know, give rise to a much stronger economy, a much more peaceful country, and you know, we will have less of the problems that we're seeing Europe go through right now with high youth unemployment and with you know, real concerns about political instability, if we can figure out a way to get, you know, the American middle class growing again.
And Arthur, you spoke to a number of people who lost their jobs during the recession, who had a really hard time getting another job. In some cases, they're temporary jobs, jobs that don't pay as much as they did back then. But most of the people you spoke to have been able to find another job.
Yes, I interviewed dozens and dozens of people since 2009 when the layoffs were really at their peak and unemployment hit 10%. A guy in the story you mentioned earlier was so desperate to get a job in the San Francisco area in 2011 that he actually pooled resources with other unemployed people and put up a billboard with their faces on it saying, please hire us.
Mm.
And he told me, you know, that gave him confidence. It kind of worked. They got jobs. But each of these people I talked to, it really reflects what you see with a, you know, strong headline unemployment rate, where the unemployment rate is going down. But then the stuff underneath is not as good. The wages are not going up. And the gentleman and the others I talked to for this story said, yeah, they're working again, but their new jobs paid less money than their old jobs. And then the kicker with Mr. Billboard, who is a delightful guy, he said he actually got laid off last week. However, he's not nearly as despondent about it. He's really confident that there are a lot of positions, and he had already been getting interviews. But so it's better than it had been when it was all out despair, but there's a hollowness to it, and a lot of the jobs are not as good.
And that's Howard Friedenberg of Fremont, California. He and others put their faces on billboards and a website called weallneedjobs.com. And you can find Arthur's piece, all of the pieces we're talking about today, at yourcallradio.org. You can also join us at 866-798-8255 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Eric Regulli, who has been hit hardest in across Europe because of austerity plans?
Well, no doubt Europe. I guess Spain, Portugal, and Italy have been hit very hard. Ireland was, but it's come out of recession. But, I mean, generally speaking, Rose, who's getting hit now is the middle class, because you have to pay for austerity in some way. And, you know, the poor can't afford to pay taxes. The rich avoid taxes or evade them. So the middle class in Europe is really, really, really under pressure. In Italy, for example, real estate taxes have gone up enormously. Income taxes have gone up. So at the same time that wages are static or going down, so it's a double whammy. So to answer your question, really, it's the middle class that are paying for this, and their wealth is vanishing very, very quickly. And, you know, to get and with the middle class under pressure, their ability to create jobs and create companies that create jobs has been limited. So it's sort of like it's a vicious circle here. Unemployment in Italy is 13% to 14% and rising. And this is a big economy. You know, this is an economy that's bigger than Canada. So there's a lot of people out of work here, and they're getting really angry about it. And my question is, at what point do they take to the streets and burn the place down?
Wow. Well, and also, I mean, just quickly, Eric, because I know we have to let you go in 1 minute. They're in the case of Greece, they're going to the left party. Do you think we'll see that in other European countries?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. There's a party in Spain called Podemos, which means Spanish for "we can," inspired by Obama, of course. It did not exist a year ago. Today, it is the leading party in the polls. It is very much like Syriza, which is expected to win the Greek election on Sunday. It is It is not anti-euro or EU, but it's anti-austerity, and it too thinks the debt has to be written down and that people have suffered enough from austerity. So yes, austerity is spawning what I would say is anti-establishment parties as opposed to, you know, left-wing parties.
Well,
some of them are right-wing. But yeah.
Right, and we'll talk about that after the break, about what's happening here in the U.S. But we will definitely continue to follow this, and we'd love to have you back. Eric Regulli with the Globe and Mail, thank you for joining us. It's your
thank
call.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back after this.
Many ways that you can take part in the conversation on Your Call, on the phone by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, you can call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll talk about a new documentary, Sand Wars. What do you know about sand mining? We're talking about beach sand. Modern society depends on it. Every year, 15 million tons of sand is used for homes, skyscrapers, sidewalks, airports, even toothpaste. But how long can this last? Is sand an infinite resource? How can we protect this vital natural resource? That is on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. We're joined by Arthur Delaney. He is a reporter with the Huffington Post, where he covers unemployment and the economy. Find his recent pieces about Republican governors pushing drug tests for nutrition assistance and other safety net programs. He's also been interviewing people who lost their jobs during the recession. And we're joined by Jim Tankersley. He's an economic correspondent with The Washington Post. He wrote an in-depth series called Why America's Middle Class is Lost. He profiled people living in Downey, California. It's a suburb of Los Angeles. And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on economic coverage? Most of what we're seeing out there is true. The U.S. economy grows incredible 5%. Third quarter growth, strongest in 11 years. That's true. But at the same time, wages are flat. People are finding jobs that aren't paying well and aren't providing any benefits. So what are your thoughts on how reporters should deal with all of these truths? Many different things are happening for different people at the same time. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. So it's so interesting to talk with Eric regularly about how people who've been hit really hard in Europe are moving to anti-austerity parties. In the case of Greece, it's a radical left party called Syriza. And Arthur, here in the U.S., we're seeing a resurgence of the right, with the right recently taking over the House and the Senate. So what are your thoughts on that and how that's being covered?
Yeah, when the economy here was really going down the tubes, instead of an anti-austerity resurgence, we had the opposite with the rise of the Tea Party that was partly animated by animus toward President Obama bailing out loser homeowners. And I think it continues to be reflected in things like proposals to drug test people on welfare. There's a lot of that, and it really picked up in 2011, and it's still going on. It's Paul LePage, the governor of Maine, and Scott Walker in Wisconsin, who has presidential ambitions, thinks that's a winning issue because it resonates with folks who are maybe formerly middle class, who aren't poor enough to qualify for that kind of benefit, who might have feelings of resentment, shall we say, toward other people who are getting help from the government.
You write about Senator Rand Paul, who during a two-day tour through New Hampshire, the first Republican primary state, said, quote, "What I tell people is if you look like me and you hop out of a truck, you shouldn't be getting your disability check. Over half of the people on disability are either anxious or their back hurts. Join the club." Who doesn't get up a little anxious for work every day and their back hurts? Everybody over 40 has a little back pain, end quote. And so, you know, it's important to note that people on disability insurance are getting about $1,200 a month. That's the average payout, right?
Absolutely. And this has been another perennial concern for Republicans, the rise of disability insurance, which added about, you know, its roles increased about 20% as the economy got worse. And for the most part, it's probably people who had jobs when the economy was good, but could have probably qualified for disability. Maybe they did have anxiety or musculoskeletal problems, or they had other serious problems. But because jobs were available, they took them. And when the jobs went away, they reached for, you know, whatever else they could do to survive. And that's what happened to be it. But Republicans are poised to do something to reform that program in the current Congress. It's definitely something they signaled will be a top issue after things like immigration.
Right, exactly. And I want to talk to both of you about that in a minute. But first, on reporting on this segment of the population, Stephen Greenhouse, who reported on labor for the New York Times, retired recently. We're going to have him on soon. He wrote a piece about how we're seeing more journalists writing about what working people and the poor are going through. He writes, quote, "But ever since the Great Recession began in late 2007, thank you, Wall Street, the news media media have devoted far more attention to workers. More and more reporters and editors concluded it was important to cover what was happening to workers, how they're being thrown out of their jobs, foreclosed upon, forced into part-time work, strong-armed into accepting wage freezes, relegated to long-term unemployment. The media's interest in issues like these has remained high long after the recession ended, partly because the downturn opened the eyes of many reporters and editors to the plight of the American worker, and their eyes remain open. Jim, what are your thoughts about that?
I mean, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I also think that what the downturn has done is it has laid bare really, really vividly the structural things that have been going on in the economy for a while that you could or could not see, depending on where you were. I mean, look, a lot of economics reporting at the big papers is based out of Washington or New York, and those are cities that have been doing great for a long time, relatively speaking, economically, but still have big pockets of poverty and struggling middle classes. But you can miss them if you want to just write about numbers or, you know, anything that's not people in the economy. I think what the recession did and what students really, really write about is get a lot of people focused on folks actually out in the economy who are hurting. And just like Arthur was saying, with people getting back to work, even when the recession kind of faded and people got back to work, it was revealed that they were still struggling, and they had been for a long time. Middle classes had to borrow just a ton of money just to keep up its living standards over the last couple of decades. And stories like that are getting harder and harder to ignore, I think, because the facts are just getting more and more stark. So I think it's a combination of, the recession helped us to see what was going on, but it's also just what's going on has just gotten to be a very high-volume thing that, if you spend any time out of the big cities in the country at all, you really understand that people are feeling and they're hurting.
How often do you get to leave Washington? And so if you go to your editors and say, hey, I heard there's a really interesting story in Downey, California, a suburb of Los Angeles. How were you able to spend time in Downey and do this piece?
Well, so we my editors, to their immense credit, I've been writing a lot of pieces about the middle class that were data-based and occasionally very human, and I like to write stories with people. I think that's how you help people understand complex information. But my editors, at some point in 2013, came to me and said, we'd really like you to tell the full story here. Tell us, like, not just in parts. Give us a big, sweeping look at what's happened in the middle class. And I said, okay, but if we're going to do that, we've got to tell a few stories about people. And they said, yes. And so we set about to look for places around the country where we could best tell that story. And we picked Downey because it didn't seem like the sort of story you've heard. I mean, there's a particular story that reporters do know very well, the Rust Belt story, basically. Factory shut down, workers laid off, jobs shipped to China or Mexico or wherever. So we picked Southern California because it seemed sort of the opposite of that. Janandine and Surf City and a place with the real American dream alive and well. And what we wanted to show was that, no, even there, even in this part of the country that you think of iconically as a place where the middle class is doing great, it's not.
Hmm. How do you decide, and what's the process involved when you try to put in context and explain to readers how we got here? Because as you say in your story, it used to be that when the U.S. economy grew, workers up and down the economic ladder saw their incomes increase. But over the past 25 years, the economy has grown 83% after adjusting for inflation, and the typical family's income has not budged. In that time, corporate profits doubled as a share of the economy. Workers today produce twice as many goods and services per hour on the job as they did in 1989. But as a group, they get less of the nation's economic pie. In 81% of America's counties, the median income is lower today than it was 15 years ago. So what about, talking about how we got here? Because I'm hearing a lot of politicians, a lot of Republicans also, almost sounding like Elizabeth Warren. But it's very rare to hear anyone talk about why we're in this place today. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think one of the reasons that I wanted to write that story in particular, first off, was to there has been for a decade or so a big pushback against this story. This idea, the middle class is actually doing better than you think. There's still some smart economists who make this claim, but there are fewer of them now. The idea that things are actually fine, people just aren't noticing it. And I think the other reason why we needed to do a big historical sweep was to say, like, you're not crazy, readers. You are feeling this. When I just go and talk to people around the country, when I'm out on any kind of story, I just ask them how things are going. And for the most part, they're like, yeah, I kind of miss the 90s. Or depending on where you are, I kind of miss the 80s because that's when we really, you know, we really had it good. So I think giving those historical sweeps and giving that context is a way of saying, hey, this is what's happening is reflected in the data. What's happening to you in your life? And the other thing is to say that it doesn't have to be that way. You know, when you look all the way back to World War II, you can say there was this time when American growth lifted everybody. And so, I mean, I try to be optimistic about this particular part of our economic story and say that should be the rule, not the exception.
Arthur, what are your thoughts on that? And in terms of bringing in context, talking about how we actually got here.
Well, they're in everyday news coverage of the economy, a lot of times people will refer to the stock market, and they'll use its ups and downs as shorthand for what's going on. And for the past 2 years, it's been basically a really positive story, and same goes for GDP growth. But the fact is, you're talking about shareholders, and this money is basically being vacuumed up by people who are rich enough to own shares. And a colleague of Jim's named Jialin Yang did a great story a couple years ago for the Post about how the whole concept of shareholder value being like an American value is a totally new one. And so that's one thing that you know, when you hear people talking about the stock market, they ought to keep that in mind. It really is not a broad indicator of what's going on in the world. And historical perspective is extremely valuable. It's great to know how things were and how we got here, how our safety net programs were born out of the Great Depression and the policy fights that led to the changes in those over the years. For instance, it's great to know that when drug tests for welfare were first the topic of discussion, it was the 1990s, the longest post-war expansion we've ever had. And does that really match up with what's going on in the Great Recession? Is a policy idea that seemed wonderful back when everything was much better, a great solution right now when things are not as good?
And before we get to calls, Jim, what kind of response do you get to a big series like the one you did on Downey, California?
I got an amazing response, and I had to tell you, I got response from people in the government in Washington, but much more gratifyingly, a lot of like handwritten letters from people around the country, emails and handwritten letters and typed out letters, people saying, hey, I experienced this. I feel this. Thank you for telling the story of someone like me. And then a lot of people, which I really loved, wrote in with their ideas. Here's how I think we can get things back on track. I've always thought that this was what was holding us back. And that's just my favorite part of the job, is talking to folks who are really engaged in this, because, again, they see it happening in their own lives and their own backyards.
Oh, we just got an email from Ruby with a long email with solutions about how to get out of this. But she said the upshot, the weekly piece on page 3 of the New York Times front section yesterday, compared the U.S. economy with Canada, Australia, and Sweden, and looked at how our wage stagnation is not the case in the aforementioned Western countries, whose wages rose from the year 2000 to present day by 10% to 30%. Wow. So thank you for that, Ruby. We'll find that piece and put it at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Jim Tankersley. He is an economic correspondent with the Washington Post and editor of The Storyline. You can find his series on Downey, California, a suburb of Los Angeles, at yourcallradio.org. Arthur Delaney is a reporter with the Huffington Post, where he covers unemployment and the economy. And you can find a lot of his pieces also at yourcallradio.org. People who lost their jobs during the recession have been able to find jobs, but they don't pay very well. And in some cases, they don't know if they're going to have them long term. If you'd like to join us to talk about coverage of the economy, what do you think? It's been dominating headlines, and the economy grows incredible 5%. That's true. And the middle class is having a really hard time. That's true. So what are your thoughts about what you're seeing? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Hi, good morning. As you will know, a businessman goes through that much, much more and feel it than most other American citizens. And are you there?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. In the 80s, they had one of the biggest electronic shop in the whole Bay Area with about 100 employees and over $30 million worth of business. All of a sudden, I saw all manufacturing in electronics going to Japan, then Korea, then to China. And all of that was facilitated by Reagan, who allowed Japanese companies to price fix products, so the product were much more profitable. And the whole thing really was done by few so-called economists, Milton Friedman, Greenspan, and the rest of them were still in control. The whole, anybody tell me the economy today is good, they're crazy. It is not good for 90% or 99% of Americans. Good for who? Mm-hmm. The fact is, the only way to fix the economy back is to bring all of the jobs that were lost back, millions of jobs. We have to nationalize banks. Those crooks in the Wall Street have destroyed the economy in this country, and they're still doing it. The biggest, horribly in history, bubble after bubble, the rest of the bubble was intentional. They robbed this country, robbed the American people of their savings, their jobs, their homes, everything. Greenspan, Friedman is dead, the rest of them should go away. Geithner, Sommer, all of these people, she would be in prison. America has to get the country back.
Thank you for the call, Ed. What are your thoughts on this, Jim? What we're going to see in the next couple of months, in fact, we're already starting to see it. The Christian Science Monitor has a piece about how Republicans are now talking about the economy, and a few pieces say that expect to hear populist language. They're going to start sounding kind of like Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, talking about how people are struggling. And Marco Rubio is out with a new book on this called American Dreams. He's saying that we got here because of regulation. There's too much regulation. How do you think the media should deal with this?
I mean, I think it starts with, and this is really hard, but you have to have at least a theory of how we got here, or at least some good evidence or some smart people to talk to. And one of the things that you have to account for, I think, in that, as you're writing about the plans for the economy now, is the fact that this economy is really different than what we saw even when Bill Clinton was president, even when Ronald Reagan was president. Like, if we just see Democrats run out a bunch of Clinton-era solutions for the middle class and Republicans run out a bunch of Reagan-era solutions, less regulation, lower taxes, the Clinton-era solutions being some changes to, more support for education maybe and some middle class, tax stuff, then I think you can fairly ask the question, well, why should that work now when it hasn't worked very well over the last 15 years? And with the Republicans, they are newer to this game right now than Democrats rhetorically. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that neither side is particularly well positioned from a policy standpoint. You just haven't seen a serious reckoning on either side. I mean, to be really honest, neither candidate in the last presidential election offered anything close to a comprehensive plan to help revive middle class wages. Mm-hmm. And so now, I think the hope would be now that they actually get their brightest thinkers on it and they start trying new things. If it's just a bunch of tax cuts and it's the difference is they go to, the Democrats want to give them to one group and the Republicans want to give them to another, it's hard for me to see how that actually adds up to a comprehensive strategy.
Arthur, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we're going to have a new-ish debate in this Congress, and the White House is going to play a much bigger role on this topic they have in the past. Family and sick leave. This is something Barack Obama said. He's giving an executive order so that workers, when they have a child, can take 6 weeks off of pay leave. The U.S. is the only wealthy country in the world that doesn't have some kind of guaranteed paid leave policy. This is one small thing that would make regular people's lives easier so that when you have a kid, you don't also have to take a round of economic punishment if you want to stay home and help that child grow.
And whatever happened to long-term unemployment benefits? That's something you've been writing a lot about, Arthur.
Oh, we got rid of those a year ago, and the issue just kind of went away. Democrats kept the pressure on that for about half the year, but the data wasn't doing anything one way or the other to settle the argument, except long-term unemployed people have been, the population of people who've been out of work 6 months or longer has been falling by about 1 million per year. And even though economists don't know whether they're getting jobs or actually giving up and withdrawing from the workforce, I think the shrinking of that population basically caused the debate to end.
Hmm. That is Arthur Delaney. He covers unemployment and the economy for the Huffington Post, and Jim Tankersley is economic correspondent with the Washington Post. And today we're talking about media coverage of the economy. And then, you know, Jim, going back to your point about politicians, the Christian Science Monitor's Mark Trumbull writes, quote, "Despite signs that the U.S. economy is rebounding, the middle class continues to struggle. Politicians from both sides of the aisle have set their sights on boosting the middle class." So we're going to get a lot of populist rhetoric from both sides. And again, because people are already talking about 2016, the State of the Union is on Tuesday night. We're probably going to get a lot of President Obama, I'm sure, is going to talk about this. And then Senator Joni Ernst on the Republican side is going to respond. How should reporters deal with this rhetoric when, as you said, there aren't many different policies on the table?
Well, I think the State of the Union is going to be a very interesting case study. The president very likely will step forward and claim credit for the economy recovering in the manner that it has, particularly in the last couple of quarters. But it's a delicate dance for him because his target voters from his appeal in 2012, those middle-class voters, still, like, the biggest thing they felt really has just been in the last month or so, which is this fall in gas prices, which I don't think anybody would suggest that federal policies have really had much of a dent on at the moment. I mean, I think that what we're going to have to see as reporters is people asking the question, what's fair and not fair for everybody to claim credit for? And what's the work left to be done? I do expect the president will lay out some other ideas he has to help the middle class get forward. And I expect that, you know, Joni Ernst and the Republicans will lay out their own ideas, too, or at least talk a good game on it on either side. And, you know, I think it's a fair question to ask, are the prescriptions they're offering really in line with the problems we're seeing? And I'm not sure. I'm actually really interested to see how it turns out.
Well, we have a few calls we can take before we have to end. Let's hear from Paul in Capitola. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First, help me out with a word that's being used in the public sector and especially by the Republicans that describes, benefits to the working poor and the poor, like welfare and unemployment. There's a word they use that indicates that it's somehow a privilege rather than a right, but I can't think of the word. And it's really an important word in a public speak that we address.
Entitlement?
Entitlement, yes.
Yeah.
Because here's what makes me furious. The top wealthiest people in the country and in the world are getting so many entitlements of tax breaks and freebies and stipends and privileges while their wealth grows and our wealth shrinks. And what I want people to understand is that the bottom line, in my view, is that this is a money grab, and it has been since the crisis in this economy, that to me it's not a recession, it's a money grab. And they want all the privileges with no responsibility socially. It's the social responsibility aspect that they're shirking when they're trying to shrink the rights and privileges of the working poor who are desperate for these help.
Thank you for calling. We'll get a response. I want to take one more caller, TJ in Santa Clara, and we're almost out of time. Hi, TJ. Oh, did TJ leave? Okay. So, Arthur, do you want to address Paul's point about entitlement and the fact that the game is just so skewed when you look at benefits?
Right. Entitlement is not, it's not meant to be a pejorative word, though I do agree that it can sometimes sound like people are trying to use it that way. It refers to a program like Social Security or even food stamps where if you qualify for it, you get it, and it doesn't matter how much, you know, money or spaces are available in the federal budget. So it just goes to everybody. And there is a lot of stuff baked into, for instance, the tax code that showers money on wealthy people. For instance, the mortgage interest deduction is probably the largest expenditure that the federal government makes on housing policy. It only goes to people who are already rich enough to have mortgages. And the amount that is spent on, for instance, affordable housing and Section 8 rental vouchers is absolutely dwarfed by the tens of billions that go to homeowners. So he makes a valid point.
And do you see that reflected in media coverage?
No, not at all.
Of course not. What about you, Jim?
I think that the coverage of the safety net is way too simplistic. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think we have very smart writing about either sort of who is really benefiting, as Arthur was saying, from the bulk of policies, and also sort of what the pressure points are on these benefits. Are there certain ways in which benefits are handed out that encourage good behaviors, like the sort of socially productive behaviors we want to see, and are there ways that others of them discourage those? I mean, traps that happen at the bottom or the middle or the top. And I think we do a very terrible job, especially when we're talking about spending out of the tax code, to really wrangle that and explain it to readers.
Jim, what are you working on right now? We've got about 30 seconds.
I'm just really interested in how this policy debate plays out over the next 2 years. I think that'll be a big focus for us. Is okay, we know there's this recognition coming on the middle class being broken. So how are folks going to fix it, and what would their prescriptions for it actually do to the economy?
And what about you, Arthur?
I'll have a feature story soon about cities arresting homeless people, contrary to an elite consensus that has formed about just giving houses to people and trying to sort out whatever problems they might have that made them chronically homeless after giving them a dignified place to live.
Mm. Well, wow, thank you. We're going to do a show actually about solutions to homelessness coming up. And I know in San Francisco there is a sleep-in on Sunday night at the Pal BART station to raise awareness about people being arrested for sleeping on the ground or sitting on the ground. So we'll definitely look for that. Thank you. Arthur Delaney is a reporter with the Huffington Post, where he covers unemployment and the economy. And Jim Tankersley is economic correspondent with the Washington Post and editor of The Storyline. You can find their pieces and all of the stories we mentioned on today's show at yourcallradio.org. Arthur and Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What do you know about sand mining? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Dennis DeLastrick, director of the documentary Sand Wars. Modern society depends on sand. Every year, 15 million tons of sand is used for homes, skyscrapers, bridges, sidewalks, and even toothpaste. But how long can this last? Is sand an infinite resource? What are the consequences of beach sand mining? And how can we protect this vital resource? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Knock Wynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.